Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning into our podcast, Hot Topics for Retirement Plan Sponsors. In today's session, I'll share some insights for fiduciaries and discuss some selected areas of fiduciary risk exposure. I am Bruce Lanzer, a retirement plan consultant with UBS in Milwaukee, and have nearly 40 years' experience working with retirement plan fiduciaries to maximize their fiduciary protection and help their employees achieve their financial goals and be prepared for retirement. So today we'll talk again about insights for fiduciaries. First area we'll cover is inadvertent fiduciary status under ERISA. Now, under ERISA, a person is a fiduciary to the retirement plan to the extent that they either exercise discretionary authority or discretionary control with regard to the management of the plan, or exercise any authority and control with the management or disposition of the plan's assets. Second, they render investment advice for a fee or other compensation, whether direct or indirect. And third, has any discretionary authority or responsibility in the administration of the plan. The U.S. Department of Labor, which oversees ERISA-sponsored plans, spells out fiduciary responsibility rules, as well as the courts, have indicated that the ERISA fiduciary definition amounts to, a functional test. What that means is that the persons performing any of those functions would be considered fiduciary regardless of their titles or designations. As a result, a person who's not formally designated as a fiduciary on a plan document could nevertheless become an inadvertent fiduciary through acting in any of these capacities. Inadvertent fiduciary status is frequently an issue under the first two parts of the definition we'd covered earlier. For instance, there have been cases in which a person acted as a broker for the plan's fiduciaries, but the fiduciaries relied to such an extent on the broker's advice that the broker was deemed to have de facto control and therefore discretion over the plan's investments, thus making that broker a fiduciary. An example is a case from 1995, Reich versus Lancaster, in which the court found that an insurance broker went beyond providing professional advice and they gained authority over the plan and in a sense became discretionary fiduciaries. As a result, they were held liable for receiving undisclosed commissions of $1.4 million in connection with the plan's purchase of some life insurance policies. The more common concern, however, is whether the person is acting as a broker consultant, is providing information about the plan investments that could be considered investment advice under the second part of the definition. The scope of the investment advice category was clarified by DOL regulation. The regulation, as has been interpreted by the courts, establishes a five-factor test, and all five of these tests must be met in order to support a finding of fiduciary status. Consequently, to constitute investment advice that would make the advisor a fiduciary, the advice must be, one, involve recommendations as to the advisability of investing in, purchasing, or selling securities or other property. Second, be provided for a fee or other compensation. Third, be individualized to the needs of the plan. Number four, be given pursuant to a mutual understanding that the advice will be a primary basis for investment decisions. It's important to note no written contract would be required. And five, the advice must be provided on a regular basis. Now, there are several steps that brokers, consultants, or others often take if they want to avoid becoming an inadvertent investment advice fiduciary. One of these is to document the party's intent as to the nature of the relationship. That can be done through agreement provisions pursuant to which the parties agree and acknowledge that the individual will not be acting as a fiduciary. In theory, that should be sufficient to negate the mutual understanding factor, as the agreement would thereby reflect a contrary understanding. Now, however, recent guidance indicates that the Department of Labor's view that a statement Disclaiming fiduciary investment advice relationship is not necessarily determinative. Instead, under this view, such a statement would be appropriately considered in reviewing the totality of the relationship. In view of the Department of Labor position and the absence of case law on this issue, brokers or consultants often take the additional step of imposing guidelines on what their personal communications to the plan will be. For example, guidelines may dictate that communications to the plan fiduciaries should avoid making any recommendations regarding plan investments by providing multiple options. Now, if you're working with an advisor for your retirement plan and your agreement does not state whether or not that individual advisor or that firm is a fiduciary, you may want to consider retaining an organization and individuals that state in your agreement that they are taking on fiduciary status, whether that be under Section 321 as an investment advice fiduciary, or Section 338 of ERISA, which is an investment manager fiduciary. Now, the next area of risk exposure we want to talk about is regarding the investment policy statement. Frequently, it's suggested that the best practice is for plan sponsors and plan fiduciaries to maintain an investment policy statement, or IPS. The IPS establishes a framework to help make decisions related to the plan investments. For a 401k plan, the IPS would typically describe a process for selecting and reviewing investment options, including which assets to cover. It also would be suggested that you spell out the criteria for evaluating the investment options and at what point would a decision be made as to whether or not to retain or replace a fund that triggers a watch status. According to the DOL guidance, however, an investment policy statement has the status of a plan document that must be complied with under ERISA, insofar as its provisions are consistent with ERISA. What this means is that an IPS may create additional set of obligations that, if not followed, could possibly lead to fiduciary liability. Nonetheless, there are significant advantages to having an investment policy statement from the fiduciary governance perspective, which may outweigh the added compliance risk. There are two steps that you can take to reduce the risk of failing to follow the IPS. First, there should be an ongoing process to review the policy to confirm that it is and remains consistent with the current practice and the plan documents. Any inconsistencies between the practice and the document should be addressed as soon as possible, either by revising the policy statement, the plan documents, or conforming to the practice as outlined. Second, the investment policy statement should be drafted to provide for flexibility in carrying out its provisions. For example, rather than requiring investment committee meetings on particular dates to review the plan investments, it could require that the investment committee generally meet once each quarter, but no less than annually, without naming specific dates in which the committee will meet. Also, rather than mandate specific investment categories or asset classes, the policy can describe the current investment categories and give the investment committee or other designated fiduciary the leeway to make changes as appropriate. Another approach would be to include a statement generally permitting the plan fiduciaries to deviate from the terms of the policy when they deem advisable. This way, minor deviations or deviations required by unexpected developments would not provide a basis for a fiduciary breach lawsuit. The next area we want to talk about is with regard to the selection process for investment options. Now, with the increased availability over the years of open architecture arrangements where the plans are not limited to a particular mutual fund family or small group of mutual funds, when using a given record-keeping platform, the process of selecting and reviewing investment options has become more complex. To be able to defend their selections, plan fiduciaries will want to be able to demonstrate a prudent process that has taken the relevant factors such as investment performance, both long-term and short-term, the fees, expense ratio, and stability of management into consideration. DOL guidance and court decisions have highlighted the importance of plan fiduciaries being knowledgeable and carrying out their responsibilities. The issue that frequently arises is that persons selected by a plan sponsor to take on fiduciary roles may not have any investment background or may only have a limited background such that they are not familiar with all types of investments being made by the plan. According to the guidance from the DOL, if fiduciaries do not themselves have the expertise to do what their fiduciary roles may require of them, they may have an obligation to seek out such expertise. Absent a complete delegation to such an expert, to the extent permitted by ERISA, the fiduciaries are still responsible under ERISA to review the issues and make their own determinations consistent with ERISA's prudence obligation, based on any recommendations or advice they receive. Nevertheless, obtaining expert advice helps to demonstrate prudence and to create a record of full consideration of those factors relevant to the particular determination. Next, let's talk about potential exposure from the selection of mutual funds that have multiple share classes. The Tibble versus Edison International case raised the issue of whether there is a fiduciary obligation to select the lowest fee share class of a mutual fund that's chosen as a plan investment option. While the court didn't find that there is an absolute obligation to select the lowest fee class, the evidence showed that the plan fiduciaries were not aware that there were lower fee classes and failed to investigate that possibility. As a result, in this particular case, the plan fiduciaries were held liable for $370,000 in losses due to excess fees paid by the plan. Now, the Tibble case instructs that if selecting a mutual fund share class other than the lowest fee share class, the plan fiduciary should document the reasons why it made sense to do so. For example, the lowest fee share class may not be available to the plan because of investment minimums or other restrictions, or the higher fee class may provide an additional benefit, for example, through paying revenue sharing that reduces the plan's direct expenses, and an explanation found that to dismiss a claim based on there being available lower share classes in Davis versus Salesforce.com. Moving on to revenue sharing arrangements. Revenue sharing is a term generally used to describe payments made by mutual funds to those who either assist in marketing and distributing shares of the funds, provide administrative services to the funds, and their shareholders, or both. It may include so-called 12b-1 fees, shareholder servicing fees, sub-transfer agency fees, or similar payments that are typically either asset-based, that is calculated as a percentage of investments in the fund, or determined based on the number of fund accounts serviced by the recipient. Frequently, such payments are made to plan record keepers based on the investments that the particular record keeper offers the plan, for which they are providing record-keeping services. The payments constitute either a portion or all of the compensation received by the record keeper for its services to the particular plan. If any revenue sharing is less than the record keeper's fees and expenses, the plan sponsor may make up the difference through direct payments. However, if the revenue sharing exceeds the record keeper's fees and expenses, then the excess may be made available to the plan to pay plan expenses or for allocation back to participant accounts. Now, revenue sharing arrangements raise a number of issues for fiduciaries. Some of these have already been addressed by the Department of Labor guidance and plan fee litigation. Others have not. For example, one issue is fiduciary obligations in overseeing revenue sharing arrangements. A DOL advisory opinion addressed the technical issue of whether bookkeeping accounts at a plan's record keeper that track certain revenue sharing payments from the plan investments and used to pay plan expenses or allocating back to the accounts constitute plan assets that must be held in accordance with ERISA. The Department of Labor said that on the facts presented, the accounts described in the opinion were not plan assets, consistent with how these types of accounts are typically handled. The advisory opinion then went on to describe the general considerations for plan fiduciaries in connection with entering into a revenue sharing arrangement with the plan's record keeper, service provider, and provided a useful guide. Some of these considerations are whether the service provider's revenue sharing or other fee arrangements involving the plan give rise to any non-exempt prohibited transactions under Section 406B of ERISA, which prohibits fiduciary self-dealing and conflicts of interest. This would be an issue to the extent that the service provider is acting as a fiduciary in selecting and removing plan investment options, either whether they have discretion to make the selections or through providing investment advice. Second is compliance with ERISA's general standards of fiduciary conduct. In this regard, according to the DOL, the plan fiduciaries must assure that the compensation the plan pays directly or indirectly to the service provider for its services received is reasonable. This requires that fiduciaries obtain sufficient information about all the fees and compensation that the service provider receives with respect to the plan's investments in order to make an informed evaluation. Next, acting prudently and in the best interests of plan participants and beneficiaries in negotiating the specific formula and methodology under which revenue sharing will be credited to the plan and paid over to the plan or plan service providers. According to DOL, this requires the fiduciaries understand the formula, methodology, and assumptions used and have the ability to periodically monitor the methodology to ensure that, among other things, any amounts to which the plan may be entitled are correctly calculated. Second issue with regard to revenue sharing arrangements is the allocation of revenue sharing amounts to the plan participants. If a plan's investments generate revenue sharing that exceeds the record keeper fees and expenses, and the plan does not use the entire excess to pay other plan expenses, the remainder may be made available for allocation to plan participant accounts. The question that arises is how to allocate the amounts to the plan participants. The revenue sharing allocation is in the nature of additional investment income to the plan participants. And on this basis, probably the most common approach is to allocate the amounts to the participants proportionally based on their aggregate account balances so that participants with larger account balances receive a larger share. However, it's possible that some investment funds may pay higher revenue sharing than others and some may not pay any revenue sharing at all. This raises the question of whether the allocation consider how participants are invested in those funds that actually make revenue sharing payments. There is no specific guidance from the Department of Labor on this issue, and their pronouncements are similar in context to the guidance spelled out here. The Department of Labor, through field assistance bulletins, favor allocating proceeds in relation to the effect the relevant activities may have had on particular accounts, but also permits balancing the cost to the plan of making the allocation in a particular manner with the associated benefits. As a general matter, the DOL has said that there should be a rational basis for selecting the allocation method and that the method should be reasonable, fair, and objective. Now, to address this point, some plan fiduciaries have considered allocating revenue sharing to the participant accounts in proportion to the participant account investments in the particular funds that generated the revenue sharing. Others have utilized structures that equalize or levelize the revenue sharing across the various plan investment options, such as through imposing an additional layer of fees on investments and funds that pay less or no revenue sharing. However, there are costs and complications to these approaches. So in absence of further guidance, the fiduciaries can seek to address this potential risk by one, having an allocation method adopted as part of the plan document, or two, otherwise considering and documenting why the selected allocation approach is reasonable, fair, and objective under the circumstances. So in conclusion, working with ERISA plans presents a number of potential risks for plan fiduciaries and service providers, so that's important to understand and be sensitive to the issues that may arise and how to address them. We hope you found this discussion helpful. And if you would like to receive our complimentary 35-point fiduciary consideration checklist, please feel free to reach out to me at 414-289-3817. Again, that's 414-289-3817. Or you can email me. Email address is Bruce, B-R-U-C-E, .Lanser, L-A-N-S as in Sam, E-R, @ubs.com. Once again, my name is Bruce Lanser, and thank you for listening.